I'm a orthopedic surgeon at Yale School of Medicine. My name is Dan Wisnia. I focus on total joint replacement of the hip and knee and stem cell treatments to preserve the hip. I operate at our robotics center at our Milford, Connecticut campus, as well as our main campus in New Haven.
Talking with Dr. Daniel Wisnia this morning of Yale Medicine, and you specialize in joint replacement, as you said. Before we get started, why did you choose this particular specialty?
I decided to go into orthopedics because I have a background in mechanical engineering and I have an interest in medical device design. And I had some terrific mentors in medical school. And all three of those things, they sort of came together and fit my passion in terms of getting patients back to the activity level that they want to return to and also helping design new medical devices. So it sort of works really nicely at Yale. I'm able to also teach at the School of Engineering and teach a medical device design course there. So it all works really nicely together.
I was surprised in reading about what you do that people think that hip replacement is usually for elderly people or older people or maybe athletes who have beaten themselves up over the years. But you also work on people who are in their 30s and 40s, which surprised me.
That's true. There's a select group of patients in their 30s and 40s who suffer from severe hip damage, and they will need hip replacements. They have a condition which causes the hip to collapse. And in about 10% of hip replacements that we conduct nationwide in the U.S., it's due to this reason of the hip collapse.
Is that the femoral head collapse that you're talking about?
Correct. So the hip is a ball and socket joint, and it's made out of two bones. So you have your pelvis, and that forms the cup, or in technical terms, we call that the acetabulum. And then you have your thigh bone, the femur, which forms the ball, or in technical terms, we call that the femoral head. And in this younger population in their 30s and 40s, what can happen is the blood supply can become damaged. And if the blood supply becomes damaged to the femoral head or the ball, then the ball isn't getting the nutrients that it needs and it can ultimately collapse. And then these patients don't have a functioning hip. It's very painful. And then they need a hip replacement.
What can cause that cutoff of the blood supply to the femoral head?
There's a few main causes. One of the main ones that we see frequently are patients who are on high dose steroids. So patients who have very severe asthma or autoimmune disease, they may require high dose steroids. And we've seen that these steroids can impact the vasculature to the hip and cause this. Another very common reason for this is excessive alcohol use. And we will see this in young patients who drink excessively. And a third reason is trauma. So if the patient suffered a very severe fall or a hip dislocation, that can affect the blood supply also to the hip and cause this.
How do you find out that this is the problem? Is that found by x-rays or is there a lot of pain also involved?
It usually starts very slowly. And the patient will come to clinic with a very subtle complaint of some minimal pain in the joint, usually saying they're having some pain in their groin or their buttock. They'll notice some increased stiffness in the hip. And sometimes the patient will complain that they're noticing some catching or clicking in the hip. And we'll start by taking an x-ray. And a lot of the time on the x-ray, we can actually see subtle signs that this condition is occurring, which is called avascular necrosis of the hip. And then the next step would be to get an MRI of the hip. The MRI lets us look at the soft tissue and the vascular supply to the hip.
Does it affect any other part of the body from the hip, like maybe the groin area or the buttocks, as you mentioned?
Because the ball or the femoral head is collapsing, that causes the cartilage to wear down faster. So the hip is a ball and socket joint. Both bones are covered in cartilage. You may have seen cartilage when you're eating, let's say, a chicken leg. At the ends of the chicken, you can see that white glistening substance. That's cartilage. That's what lets the bones glide against each other. And with this condition, the cartilage will wear away and fall apart. And that can become very painful if the bones are grinding against each other.
Sure. So how do you fix this?
There's two ways to go about it. If we can find this very early on, and that's before the hip has collapsed, there are treatments that we're doing at Yale where we will place some stem cells into the ball to try to reinvigorate the blood supply to the femoral head. So these are your own stem cells that then bring new blood flow and new healthy cells to the hip, and it can actually prevent the hip from collapsing. The other thing that we do is we will obtain an MRI of the other side, of the other hip. So when we obtain the MRI of the other side, sometimes we will actually see that the process has happened on the opposite side as well. And that can happen in as many as 80% of patients. Unfortunately, if we catch this at too late of progression and the hip has already collapsed, we have to conduct a total hip replacement.
I was going to ask, when you do replace hips, is it smart to do both hips, or does the body adjust to one being replaced and the other being left alone?
That's a great question. So that's something that a lot of patients will ask, because when they're coming into clinic, they may have one hip that is the primarily painful hip, but the other hip may not be that far behind it in terms of pain. I always say that you should focus on the hip that hurts the most and address that one first and see how you feel after you've had the hip replacement. And sometimes patients feel a lot better and they don't require surgery on the other side. But now that the really painful hip has improved, now they're more active and they're doing more activities. And that can lead to some increased wear on the other hip. And they may ultimately need a hip replacement on that side also. But there are some patients who one side is very arthritic and one side is very healthy. And you should only really address the hip that has an issue. And you shouldn't, if the other hip is healthy and fine, you want to keep it that way, and you wouldn't do a hip replacement on that.
When you were talking about stem cells, you said that you get them from your own body. Where would you get them from, and do they always take?
That's a great question. What we do is we take the stem cells from the pelvis. And the reason we take the stem cells from the pelvis is that the pelvis has a lot of bone marrow. And within the bone marrow, we have what we call progenitor cells. These are stem cells that can form cell lines to replace bone, to replace blood vessels. So we're able to make a very small, minimally invasive nick in the skin and obtain a lot of stem cells. And the patient is then able to use their own stem cells to regenerate the worn out blood vessels and the bone. Now, how effective is this treatment? We know that without this treatment, about 50% of these patients, their hip will collapse. We know with this treatment, over 75% of these patients will actually not have their hip collapse and they won't need a hip replacement.
Wow.
It can make a big difference, especially in a very young patient who a hip replacement is a big surgery for them, because a hip replacement lasts about 20, 25 years. A young patient is really going to use that hip replacement a lot more than an older patient would. They're going to be more active in terms of the activities that they do every day, what their job demands of them. So if we can retain our natural hip, that's really preferred to doing a hip replacement in a younger patient.
There's also the anterior and posterior approach to doing hip replacement. And you are, I understand, a pioneer in the anterior approach. Could you explain the difference between the two?
First of all, what I'll tell you is that I feel that both approaches are just terrific. Okay. And you want to find a surgeon who you trust, who is comfortable conducting the surgery with the approach of their preference. And the second thing I'll tell you is, if you look at the outcomes from large studies, large clinical database studies where we're looking at millions of patients, there really has not been a big difference between the anterior and posterior approach. So what I tell patients is you want to pick the surgeon and not the approach. The second thing is, in terms of the approaches, they each have their own little issues. And if you look at the number of sort of issues or complications associated with each approach, they're the same. They're just different types of complications. So with the anterior approach, benefit of the anterior approach is that patients get back to work faster, their pain's a little bit less. However, it has known increased risks of wound breakdown, infection, and femur fractures. On the other hand, with the posterior approach, the recovery is slower, but the risk of the wound breakdown and infections and fractures are lower, but it does have a higher risk of dislocation of the hip. So you'll get the same number of complications. They're just a little bit different. And in the hands of a really practiced orthopedic surgeon who's comfortable with the approach that they're using, I think you'll get the same outcome. If you look at patients 3 months out from surgery, you don't see any difference in terms of recovery, in terms of ability to do activities or pain or function. So my suggestion to all patients is you want to find a surgeon who really feels comfortable operating on you and that they can handle your case and the complexity of your case.
Are the wounds to go in as large depending on whether you go in anterior or posterior?
They're about the same size.
Okay. And what about recovery in general? I've heard that surgeons like to get the patient up on their feet as soon as possible, maybe even the same day.
At Yale, we get the patients up and out of bed the same day of surgery. They work with a physical therapist. They're actually learning how to use stairs, how to conduct activities of daily living, such as transferring in and out of bed, getting in and out of a car, using the bathroom. A lot of our patients actually go home the same day. Some patients need a little bit of extra help and they'll stay one night. There's a very small subset of patients who require a lot of extra help, don't have a safe home situation or support at home. And for that small subset, they'll usually go to rehab. Yeah. But all of our patients who do go home, they'll have a nurse see them at home. They'll have a physical therapist visit them at home.
Is a hip replacement, in your view, a foregone conclusion with most people? Or are there other things that can be done short of going through a hip replacement procedure?
When I see a patient in my clinic, I really want to understand how active they are, and how much their hip pain is impacting their activity. I have some patients with very severe arthritis, but they're highly functional, doing an incredible amount of activity, and their pain level is minimal. For those patients, maybe they don't need a hip replacement immediately. I try to really stretch out the non-operative conservative treatments first. They're having trouble, let's say, grocery shopping or interacting with their family. They're cutting back on their activity. They consider that they might start to use a cane. Maybe they're not taking as long of a walk as they used to. Then I think it is very reasonable to think about a hip replacement.
Does weight impact the decision to have a hip replacement at all?
It does, and it's a very good question. So when I first see a patient and we're considering conservative treatment, weight is definitely one item that we discuss. First of all, the hip is a ball and socket joint. Every extra pound of weight that you have is an extra 10 pounds through the hip.
Ooh.
So if you can take off 10 pounds, that's actually 100 pounds of load that the hip joint will experience.
Wow.
So it can make a big difference. That's one thing that I really focus with my patients. There is a lot of research looking at the risk of operating on heavy patients. And there's a lot of data demonstrating that there is a higher risk of heart attack, stroke, death, blood clots, infection when operating on heavier patients. So I spend a lot of time with my patients helping them lose weight before the surgery. And a lot of patients, after they lose a good amount of weight, will even say, you know what, I feel pretty good now that I've lost this weight. I'd like to hold off on the surgery.
That must be great for you and for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's always an accomplishment when a patient can lose weight. It's very hard to do. Mm-hmm. So at Yale, what we do is we have a nutritionist team that will meet with them. We actually have a metabolic weight loss clinic where they use medication to help the patients lose weight. And then if they're still struggling, We also can have the patients consider bariatric surgery. So we have a lot of different options to help them with weight loss on the road to considering a hip replacement.
Do you use pain shots to alleviate hip pain and other pain in that area before you opt for surgery?
That is one conservative non-operative treatment that I do offer patients. What you can do is you can inject some numbing medicine, and you can also inject some cortisone into the hip. There's also a procedure that we offer at Yale where we numb up some of the nerves around the hip. It's called a nerve denervation procedure. And these can give the patient some pain relief. Usually they can last from 3 months to a year. Sometimes they don't last as long. Patients who have very severe arthritis, unfortunately, these procedures don't work as well as someone who has mild arthritis.
Well, you have been just a font of amazing information. Anything that you want to tell me about that I didn't ask you about, or you'd like to underline anything that you had said?
I guess what I would want to really emphasize is before you rush to surgery, really consider those conservative non-operative treatments first. And in terms of non-operative ways to take care of our hip, one thing that I really like to coach patients about are low-impact exercises. So these are things such as walking, swimming, biking, using the stationary bike, using an elliptical trainer, doing Pilates or yoga, and not doing high-impact activities like running or excessive stairs or jumping. These pounding exercises can really exacerbate an arthritic hip. And the other thing I would like to get across is that we have to be very aware of our bone health and making sure that we're taking calcium and vitamin D in our diet is very important to make certain that our joints stay healthy.
Do you think that any physical labor can contribute also to not only hip pain, but the need for a hip replacement?
Certainly your activities and the work that you do can place more wear and tear on the joints. That's something that you have to look out for if you do have a job where you're on your feet, where you're doing heavy lifting. You have to make certain that you're not taking on too much of a load with each trip and that you have the equipment available to really protect your joints.
You have been fantastic, and I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're a busy man, but I appreciate you taking the time so much with me this morning.
Well, I hope this was helpful.
Oh, my goodness.